Is that good? Okay, I guess that was the voice. Okay, great. Yeah, so first of all, thanks a lot for inviting me, the three of you here. Yeah, it's great that you gave me so much time. So, you know, you have to listen a really long time to me. So I hope it will be fun, but I guess it will be fun. It's a topic that I guess has a lot of overlap with what many of you are doing, but it's also a bit broader. I'm not talking much about quantum theory this morning. It's basically about the question how and why you might want to start with observers as fundamental and have see physics as something derived from it, and how you can do that by using algorithmic information theory. Now, here are three observers. So one of them is Mike, my colleague Mike, and I'm really glad to work with him. He's a philosopher of physics, and he's funded by FQXI to think with me about some of that stuff. And these are formerly known Alice and Bob, now Abby and Bambi, the two guinea pigs. And I put them up because people get really angry when I put humans into all these thought experiments that I will send them in. So here we go. Good. So now in this talk, what I'm going to do is I will first give you some motivation. Why should we think along these lines? Why would that maybe make sense? Then I give you the postulates of the approach that I'm talking about. And then I tell you what follows from these postulates. And one claim is that we can understand, in some sense, why there is a world as a consequence of something simpler. And then in the fourth part, it will have to do what happens if you have more than one observer and how something like objectivity can come from that. So there's another one in the afternoon. Good news is what I'm talking about the afternoon has not much to do with the morning. So you can go there and basically forget most of what I say now. In the afternoon, I will talk about quantum theory. Mainly, it's about a very simple formalism, how you describe observers, like Sleeping Beauty here, and their change in time, how the state changes with certain probabilities, and kind of questions you can ask and properties you can have there. And then what this may have to do with quantum theory, or with some aspects of quantum theory, maybe. But this will be this afternoon. So let's start here with a bit of motivation. So motivation for me to look into this stuff was what I would call some systematic conceptual problems that we have in physics and maybe around physics. Now, the problem, in a way, that you're most familiar with is they're all coming from quantum theory. So people talk about the measurement problem. Now, what that really means is up to debate. There's Bell's theorem. What does Bell's theorem tell us? Well, some of us would say that it tells us that, in a way, sometimes there are, or sometimes questions don't have answers before we look, or before we measure. And so you can make that go in a bit of a different direction, and then you hear things like Renato Renner's or Czeslaw Bruckner's no-go results for facts of the world. So it seems in some cases this just doesn't really make sense to talk about a world that's just there and that we're just observing. In cosmology, there are other problems that we in this community tend not to think about. For example, how do we assign probabilities if we live in a really big universe? There's the Boltzmann brain problem, for example. I guess most of you have heard of the Boltzmann brain problem somehow. Okay, or the question, why do we have low entropic initial conditions? How do we put measures on possible worlds and so on? Then there are all these more far off questions here, which I think are nevertheless important, maybe future technology. So at some point we may be able to simulate observers on a computer. Now what does that mean? Or what about the simulation hypothesis? There are philosophers that talk about maybe we live in a simulation. Also in philosophy, there's a problem of induction. There's Scott Goodman's new riddle of induction. There's some certain hard problems in philosophy of mind. And also just naive human curiosity. In a way, you can ask, well, why is it actually the case that there is something like a world with laws out there somehow? Maybe can we actually maybe ask this question in a meaningful way? You know, the claim here is that all these points here and these questions they point in one particular direction. They have something in common. Namely, the point in direction where we have an approach where not a world, but observers or observations are fundamental in some way. Yeah. Well, why not a world? Well, we have in quantum theory all kinds of problems with talking about this one single world out there. When we want to ask why is there the world at all, then we shouldn't assume it in the first place. Yeah. Then if we have the problem of induction, why does induction work? Then, well, actually, here, if you talk about observers and the probabilities of observations, that's directly related to induction, as we will see. Now, what about cosmology? Let me just give you this one question that these people talk about, because I will refer to that later. It's this Boltzmann brain problem. So here's the problem in a very, very short nutshell. So, yeah, here's something that cosmologists like to write papers about. So you have a very big universe, really big, and then what happens is you have statistical processes, maybe thermal fluctuations, and then, of course, if the universe is large, then improbable events will happen from time to time. For example, a brain will just show up somewhere at random. It will say, wow, I hope I'm not just randomly formed. So maybe it's just formed randomly, maybe with memories. So you think you're just sitting here now. Yeah, you had this life before, you traveled yesterday and so on. But in fact, you've just been randomly created out there in the universe with all your false memories. And in the next moment, you will suddenly realize, oh, what's going on? I'm suddenly in space. What the hell? And then you disappear. So that's a bit the idea. And then one argumentation that you find in these papers, and this is really a sketch, is the following. So what you might want to do is you say, well, maybe I look at a certain cosmological model, X, that I'm interested in. Maybe a model with eternal inflation. And suppose that predicts that the universe is very, very large. Then what can I do? Well, in this model, I can try to count how many Boltzmann brains there are to be expected. And then I can try to compare it to the number of normal brains, like the usual ones, like us, that are to be expected. And if there are to be expected, there are much more Boltzmann brains than usual ones, then these people argue that, well, in the next moment, we should all make an observation of that kind, like, what? I'm in space and disappear. Yeah. But since this is not what we see, this doesn't seem to work, and this means that the cosmological model is falsified. So this is seen as some kind of constraint on your cosmological model. Yes?
Maybe this is a naive anthropocentric argument, but why would we be expected to see this? We're confined on Earth, and we already are not of this type.
Well, you think you're confined on Earth.
Okay, so it's the fact that I'm not vanishing suddenly these could all be false memories. That's the point.
Yeah, it could be false memories, and if for every actual you here on Earth, there are like 10 to the 100 Boltzmann brains out there that just think they've been on Earth, then, but I mean, okay, so this is not what I've made up, this is something cosmologists discuss, and the question is, of course, is this a valid argumentation or not? Or something along these lines, can we argue in that form? And whatever your answer is, we say, yes, of course, or no, obviously not, the answer seems to rely on more than a statement about the world. Just knowing that these fluctuations happen doesn't really answer you the question whether this is a valid argumentation or not. So somehow we need something else to answer this question. Okay, so we have all these problems here, and now the claim is that in a way we can approach them by talking about observers or observations as fundamental and about the probabilities of your future observations given past observations. The idea is that this is a fundamental quantity. The probability that we see something in the future given that we've seen something in the past. So let's sketch this a bit more. What's a general approach? The approach is just drop the idea that we're part of a world, just drop this assumption, and then start with these probabilities. Say, for every single observer privately, there's a probability of some next observations given the previous observations. So maybe previously I know that I've seen a laboratory with some lasers and some stuff that I put on the table, and I've pressed a button, and then I want to see what's the probability that I see a certain spot of light shine somewhere, or a certain detector click. That would be an example of a conditional probability distribution. And the claim here is that we sort of start with those. They are somehow fundamental. And so these observations here are just states of the observer, like whatever you know now, whatever information is accessible to you at a given moment. And then what we do is we say this probability, this should just be a certain thing that we postulate. It should be namely algorithmic probability. So what is that and why is that? I will come back to that. So there are certain structural arguments that motivate this. Then we just see what follows. And if that's true, if you make this assumption, does what follows fit with the actual physics that we see? Yeah. Now to the motivation, I come back again. So let me first make a disclaimer. Yeah. So when I talk about observer, then this is really just a technical information theoretic notion. And don't talk about consciousness or anything like that. Also, when I say, can we get physics as a consequence of this, I'm not trying to build a theory of everything. It doesn't work. we will actually see that what I'm showing you is useless for most things. So you cannot use that to compute any cross-sections of anything. So this will just be a very fundamental theory, answering very fundamental questions if you take it seriously. Then if we drop the idea of a world, I'm not saying that the world is not real, but just that it's not fundamental. But the standard view works to good approximation still. So that's where we're going. Okay, now how is that thing built? So how can we do this now? So somehow I want to talk about our observer being in certain states over time. So we need some minimal ingredients. And what are the smallest ingredients that we need to build a theory? Somehow we need to say that an observer can be in some state at any given moment. So here, for example, here's our observer at some moment, and there's something that the observer sees and maybe remembers and, everything, all the information that's locally accessible to him, which could be a long string of zeros and ones. That's just his state. In the next moment, there might be another state, so something changes. Maybe the observer decides to walk a bit along the street, sees something else. It's another state, and then it's another state, and so on. And then if this is what's the state now, then there will be another state next. So it will be in some other state next. Now, of course, when we stand behind a wall and we look behind it, then we expect more to see something like this than suddenly to be in space. So it seems that some observations are more probable than others, given what we've seen before. And that's also something we need. We need that some states are more probable than others. But that's basically all we need in some sense. So what we need is some kind of stochastic process. And that's all we assume here. What about agency? Yeah, well, what about the choice of the observer to ask a certain question? What about the world and quantumness? Well, don't want to postulate this, but maybe we can partially derive some of this later. That's the idea. Want to make very minimal assumptions. So here's the postulate. It's just one, and it says that you have the observer's state, and you represent it by a binary string of zeros and ones. You can also use the natural numbers. It doesn't really matter, but that's one thing, one way to do it. And one moment after the other, you get just a sequence of these strings, which is one state, the next state, the next state, and so on. And now the claim is that we have to, we have to postulate what the probability is of the next state given the previous ones, and that's this expression here, probability of the next state given all the previous ones, and this P is now, by definition, conditional algorithmic probability. Okay, so that's all I'm assuming here. And in particular, I'm not assuming that this probability comes from some incomplete knowledge of some world, for example, or from some quantum state from which we would compute these probabilities via some Born rule or anything. So somehow this is just a probability that describes fundamental irreducible chances just in itself. And when you ask, well, what do these zeros and ones mean? Then the answer is not a whole lot of much. It doesn't really matter. It's not the actual 0-1 sequence that means that's relevant, but somehow the relation between the different strings, some of the computability structure in the end will be important. It's a bit like in general relativity, where the coordinates don't really matter, but the differentiable structure that relate the different coordinates. And here it's a bit the same, but with zeros and ones. So what is algorithmic probability? And why do we postulate it here? Yes.
A question that maybe you can answer later during the discussion that I just, because it just popped out. The observer has this kind of states and makes observation about, the problem is, I mean, you say that you're not assuming any external reality, so what?
Yes, not yet.
What are these states about?
Yes.
Why do they emerge? Why does the observer do these things?
Yeah, so I mean, as usual, you make postulates and then you derive consequences of the postulates. No? If you postulate that the law of gravity falls off like 1 over r squared, then of course you're also not making claims right away why this is the case or what actually mediates the force, right? You just claim that and then you work out the consequence. A bit like this here. But I hope that the intuition of what that all means and what kind of worldview this gives you in the end will become more clear when I go on here. So first of all, what is algorithmic probability? Well, in a way, what we want is, of course, we want to say for these states, so here's a history of an observer, first this state, then that state, then that state. It's like a history here. How can we put probability measures on them? And what is this P that I've postulated here? Let's just in general talk about general measures on these histories. What are they? Well, here's a boring example how you could put a measure on histories. You say, well, if I have a binary string x1, then its measure is just defined as 2 to the minus the length of the string minus 1 or something like this. So the measure of that string would, for example, be 2 to the minus 9. Just something I have randomly defined. And then you say, if you have more than one string, let's just take the product distribution. So what would that describe? Well, it would describe basically an observer that makes a randomly some, is in some state, probably a short describable state, and then independently in the next state, and completely independently in the next state, and so on. Formally, we just have these properties. A measure satisfies normalization. And if I add over the last possible state, then I just get the probability of the history up to the state before. So this would be a measure on such histories. There are also semi-measures where you have the same, but not equality, but you have inequality here. So less than or equal. Yeah. Okay. Now, here's an interesting notion, namely computability. When would a measure be computable? We say it's computable, basically, if a computer program can estimate it. So if we have a computer program where we input the strings, and also a parameter, a natural number, and what we get is the measure as an output up to 1 over m error. So we tell the computer, give us the measure of these strings up to this error. And if that's possible, then it's computable. Enumerable is a bit less strong. Enumerable only means that you have a computer program that where we feed in some strings and we want the measure out, but you won't get the measure exactly. Again, we get an approximation mu m, which is less than the actual value, and in the limit converges to this value. So if this is your actual value, then the computation from below just goes to it very slowly in the limit. You don't really know how quickly this is going. That's why this is a bit weaker, and that's enumerability. A universal enumerable semi-measure. This is what computer scientists are interested in, what you have in algorithmic information theory. So this is usually called M. This is an enumerable semi-measure, which somehow contains all others inside its convex decomposition. So what you have is, if you take another semi-measure, mu, then you find some constant such that m is larger than constant times mu. So this is, m is larger up to a constant than any other semi-measure that's computable. Any other enumerable semi-measure. So in a way, you mix all these semi-measures together, you get m. That's the idea. And now what you can do is you just pick one of those universal enumerable semi-measures and you normalize it so that probabilities add up to 1 and so on, and this defines algorithmic probability. That's one possible definition. Here's an alternative definition. Namely, you have a Turing machine, a monotone Turing machine. It reads its input bits, first bit, second bit, third bit, and so on, and then it writes its output strings, first output string, second output string, and so on. And now you can ask, what's the distribution of outputs if the input is chosen at random? So you toss a coin and get some random input, and then you look at the output distribution. Turns out that this is a universal enumerable measure, and every universal enumerable measure can be obtained in this form. So this is just an alternative definition of algorithmic probability. And what you can see from this definition is that algorithmic probability has something to say about Occam's razor in some sense. Namely, the probability, here it's the unnormalized version, but for the normalized one, this is also true. The probability of some history is larger than 2 to the minus the complexity of the history. So this k of history, is just the length of the shortest description, homograph complexity. So if your history has a short description, you can compress it very strongly, then its algorithmic probability tends to be small. So algorithmic probability favors compressibility of strings and histories. Okay. Yeah, so that's algorithmic probability in a nutshell. Now you can ask, well, of course, there are many different universal Turing machines, so which one should I choose? Doesn't it matter which one I choose? So won't the resulting theory depend on the choice of this universal machine? And then you can sit down and think for a long time, and you can say, well, no, not really. In the end, it doesn't matter. But it's actually not non-trivial why it doesn't really matter. And maybe you can ask me later if you're interested in this point. But you can choose, for now, let's just choose one of them arbitrarily. And this defines algorithmic probability. Okay, so we have this. We have an observer, first state, second state, and so on. We have a probability distribution on it, which is conditional algorithmic probability. And this is truly just the usual expression for conditional probability. Now, here's an open problem. Somehow when you say, well, the future depends on the past, actually it would be conceptually much nicer if it only depended on the present. So what you really want for what follows, and I'll come back to that, is that this distribution really only depends on your last state, the one you're currently in, xn, and not on the previous ones. And you can also do that. You can do what I'm doing now in this Markovian setting, but the problem is it's much harder mathematically, and I don't really know the consequences of this yet. But let me just put this out as an open problem because I'll come back to it later. Yeah.
Like you said, you're letting the future depend on the past, but should I think of these conditional probabilities as what the agent infers about their likely future, given their knowledge of the present or the past? Like that, I should think of these conditional probabilities epistemically, right? Not or are you suggesting that these are like propensities? This is
yes.
The likelihood of the future given the past.
So yes and no. First, the first answer is no, you should not think of them as epistemically,
okay,
but as chances.
Okay.
Because since there is no world, I need something else that enforces something or that tells me something must happen. So you need at least a notion of chance of observations, which is how I interpret this here in this possible. But then later on, if you look at this, you work out the consequences, you will find you can actually also give it an epistemic interpretation. We say, maybe there is actually a world that we don't know and don't have to talk about it, and the observer just tries to guess the future or something like this. You can do that too. It's kind of agnostic, the way it's formulated in the end. Yeah. But for now, think of chances,
okay,
objective chances. So why should we use algorithmic probability? And there are a couple of different arguments. Let me just give you one. So this is Ray J. Solomonov, who discovered Solomonov induction in the 60s, which is basically a method of induction. He was actually influenced by Karl Knapp. And the question, how do you predict the future given that you have data about the past? And what Solomonov induction tells you is, suppose you just see a bunch of bits like 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, or heads, tails, heads, and you want to assign a probability to your next bit that you see, then what you should do is you should use algorithmic probability to predict. And if you do that, then it turns out that this actually gives you quickly the correct probabilities or correct guesses if you're part of a computable probabilistic environment. So you're part of some process that you don't know, it's probabilistic, you want to guess the correct probabilities, use algorithmic probability. That will give you the right answers. And in fact, this is now studied in artificial intelligence where people try to use it in one way or the other to build actually algorithms that are learning and are predicting the future in some sense. So I find these books here. As I said, what you need is that you're part of a computable probabilistic environment. Now, it turns out that the laws of physics, as we know them today, they seem to be computable in this sense and probabilistic. For example, if we have an experiment, a description of an experiment, we can input in a computer, and we can compute the expected outcome statistics. And so this tells us that Solomonov induction is useful in the physical world. And in fact, it will predict the same probabilities that our best physical theories predict. Yeah. So it's at least as good as our physical theories in prediction. Yeah. Asymptotically, if you've made many observations, and of course you cannot really do it in practice because algorithmic probability is not computable. So you have a problem if you want to really apply it in practice. But in principle, it agrees with physics and gives you reliable predictions in the same way as physics does. So then the idea is, if that's the case, well then, let's just postulate that Solomonov induction is the law in a way. And if we do that, we know that at least this will have to be consistent with physics, given our data that we have about physics. So that's one idea where I want to put algorithmic probability and not another probability distribution at this point. Okay, let me drop the other two. So these are the postulates. Now let's see what this means. Yes.
Have you already motivated like why it's not computable?
Yeah, it's not computable because you would have to. Here, it's the probability that a random program generates certain outputs. So you would have to run through all the possible programs and see the outputs that they generate. But sometimes they don't halt, and you don't know how long you have to wait until they halt and so on.
Okay.
That's why it's not computable. Yeah, okay. So what does it mean now? So what would follow from that? And why would that be helpful if we can think of it in this way? So how would we understand that physics comes about somehow? Let me give you the first prediction. Prediction one is something I would call the principle of persistent regularities. And the idea is the following. You have a computable test F. So what's that? So it's basically something where you feed in a bit string and you get out yes or no, which is 0 or 1. And suppose that in the past, everything you've seen, when you did this computable test, the answer has always been yes. So here the test could, for example, be, is the first bit 1? And then the answer was yes, you wrote yes as well, and yes as well. And suppose this is the case. Now, you're the observer, you want to predict the future. Well, obviously what you would want to predict is that it also remains true in the future. And here's a theorem that you can prove, namely, if this is the case, then with high probability of probability close to 1, the answer will also be yes in the future. So a certain regularity that he had for a while will tend to remain there. And the intuitive reason why this is true is because a regularity like this makes the sequence of strings more compressible, and compressibility is favored by algorithmic probability. Now, this would be a way you formalize it mathematically. I'm maybe not saying much about that, but for example, if your test has given you yes, 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 n times, the probability that you see another yes is larger than 1 minus 1 over n for all but finitely many n. So you can make a statement like this. And this already indicates you how this approach gets rid of the Boltzmann brain problem. Yeah. But with a catch that I come to the next slide. So you're now this observer, and you've done a specific test. Namely, you've done a computable test where you just said, hey, are my observations, are they typical for a planet-like environment? So you just make some kind of test that's easily computable. You say, do I see the stars there and the floor there, or something like this? Obviously formulated for a computer. Suppose the answer was yes all the time. Well, then the theorem tells you that it would still be yes in the future, and that you would not expect to have the strange Boltzmann brains experience that the cosmologists want to talk about. Because regularities tend to persist, and such an experience would be highly irregular in a complexity theoretic sense. Now, this is not quite enough. So I know, not sure how many of you know Goodman's new riddle of induction, the philosopher Goodman. Yes, so here's the idea that kind of undermines all of that. So you have a computable test, maybe the one that I've talked now about just now. Are your observations typical for a planet? But here's another test that you can build from it. The other test is just the original test. If your calendar year is less than 2050, and it's the inverse test, not F, if the calendar shows a year larger than 2050. Now, and Goodman gives an example of bleen and gru instead of green and blue as like an example. And now the theorem I've shown you is also true for F tilde. So what does it tell you? Should you expect that everything switches in the year 2050, or how do you make sense of that? Well, is there a contradiction? The answer is no, there is no contradiction, because you can look a bit more closely and can say you have to look at the complexity of these tests. And if the complexity of a test is smaller, like this is smaller complexity than that test, then the corresponding regularity will stabilize itself earlier than the other one. So you try to find a description of this test, like you write a computer program that actually performs the test, and you get its length. And you would say, here's a program that has a certain length, and that other program would be a bit longer, because I have to specify this program and then this extra rule. So the complexity of F tilde would be larger. It has a longer program. And for that reason, this here would stabilize itself more quickly than that here. So in a way, yeah, how many, you need less yes instances to make that F here stable to remain on your planet, then you would need to actually see F tilde to be stable. Not by the theorem itself, and that's actually interesting because the theorem tells you that the probability is very large for all but finitely many n. Mm-hmm. And for how many n this is not the case depends then on the complexity of this test. That's how this all works together. Okay, so this is, yeah, and you can do a more careful analysis of this complexity and really get rid of the Boltzmann range in that context. So this does seem to work.
Marcus?
Yeah.
Is this your work, pointing out that you can solve Goodman's Neuve Hurdle induction using this sort of stuff?
In this context, yes. I mean, there have been other authors arguing that the complexity of your of green and blue is larger than of Blean and Gru. It's just more complex than green and blue.
But were they quantifying complexity?
No, not that I know of, or maybe, I'm not sure. But here, it's more naturally part of the theory because you're anyway talking about complexity all the time. And it enters algorithmic probability directly, yes.
Does this depend on whether you take green and blue to be your basic vocabulary or Blean and Gru? Because you can redefine.
It's a good question. So it turns out that goes a bit back to this question of machine dependence here. So the choice of a machine here, of this universal machine that defines your probabilities, that's a bit like choosing a language. Yeah. So, and then when you choose another machine, that's like choosing another language, and suddenly you might find that Blean and Gru are the actually relevant concepts. But what you find here is not so much the prediction about a single bit string or a single instance of a test, but more the relation between the different strings. That's what I said a bit earlier, where I said here, so that's what I'm referring to here, that it's not really about the actual sequence of zeros and ones, but the computability structure. Like you say, oh, here's a string of zeros and ones, that other one is kind of similar. I can easily compute it from the other. Yeah? And that would persist even if you change the machine.
Okay.
So it's like this web of interrelations between the strings that in the end makes the actual operational predictions of the theory. So translated to the language example, I would say, like, it's not the word itself that's relevant, but the web of words that defines your language and the statements that you derive from applying induction to this web of notions. Yeah. So that's hidden in the mathematics of these statements here.
Mm-hmm. How do we know that this test actually passed in the past?
You don't. You just say maybe it's just been passed by chance a couple of times. Maybe it's been passed 5 times by chance. And then there's a certain tendency that it stays a sixth time, and then...
I mean, if we have a memory of it passing, how do we know that's a true memory? Like, how do we know that is actually what we observed?
Yeah, you don't know. You don't know. It's just a claim of what happens to an observer. It doesn't mean that the observer knows it all. It's a different question, what you know versus what actually happens to you. And that turns out to be an interesting gap that I come back later in the afternoon when I talk about quantum theory. That becomes relevant somehow. This is really just a claim, oh, there's a stochastic process. The observer changes state, and that's happening to that observer. Doesn't care. Maybe he knows nothing and doesn't care, that observer. It's not epistemic. It's really a stochastic process. Okay, yeah, so this is one thing. This is just about one test that I'm doing, but I'm actually seeing some world around me, like a consistent external world that I'm a part of. That's more than just a bunch of regularities. Do these different regularities actually fit together to give a coherent picture? And the answer turns out yes. So here's a prediction too, that in some sense you will see a simple computable probabilistic world. And here's a theorem that you can prove. So what you do is you just look at any computable probabilistic process that has description length L on a universal computer. Yeah, you put your universal computer on the desk. It's probabilistic, so it can toss coins. Then you can program it, for example, to simulate some process, maybe a coin toss, an unfair one or something. And this program has a certain length, L. Now, this thing may generate some outputs, first output, second output, and third output, and so on. And since it's probabilistic, there's a distribution of these outputs, mu. And now what happens is that with probability of at least 2 to the minus L, conditional algorithmic probability converges in the long run to this measure mu. So what does it mean? On the left-hand side, this is what the observer experiences. This is the stochastic process that determines what happens to the observer. This is some other process which is computable and simple. Simple because it has a short description length L. L is small. If L is small, then this will probably happen. So in the long run, algorithmic probability will look a lot like the simple process here, which is computable, and which makes more or less the same prediction. So let me show you a picture. So you're an observer. You've run through a bunch of states, made a lot of observations. Maybe you're in the state xn now. And what you see is p-distributed according to algorithmic probability. Now, if this event here happens, then this means that what you see, your state, looks very much as if it came from some computation, some computational process, namely this one, where you have just some output, which is just part of the computation that tends to be distributed in some way. So I haven't talked about a world or anything yet, just about an observer. This is the observer, it's going through a bunch of states. But if this here holds true, then in the long run, this would just, the distribution here will look as if it came from something bigger, some computational process where the observer is just a part of. So this is, let's see. So why is that the case? Well, that's the case because of that theorem. It tells you that in the long run, P will converge to this mu, and mu is just whatever this other process gives you. So let's see. So now which process do I get? Well, it could be any process, but it's probably one that has a short description length. Because it has a short description length, then its probability is large. So in a way, this means that in the long run, it's kind of random or contingent which process you will run into, which you were a part of. But simpler processes are highly preferred, because simpler means having a shorter description length, having a higher probability in the statement. So what this means is that the observer's probabilities, what happens to you as an observer, that will just be the marginal distribution of some random variable that's part of a probabilistic process. Say this one, like Game of Life here or something. And it's a probabilistic process. It's computable, so it has computable laws, and they have a short description because it's description length L, and L is small, short. So in the long run, the observer will think, that's interesting. If I look around, it seems as if I was part of this algorithm. And that seems probabilistic, and it seems simple. I can write down a bunch of laws that seem to describe what's going on there. There's some bunch of stuff that I don't directly have access to. That's not me, so here's me, but there's this other stuff, like the food that's prepared in the kitchen now. But maybe later on, that will actually be correlated with what I see. Maybe this will hit me later on, so the food later on will taste me a lot. Yeah. So there's this external world. Isn't that interesting? And in a way, that's I would argue a way to interpret this theorem. Yes.
I'm not sure I've understood the logic, but just from the statement of the theorem that you're saying, suppose x1, x2, x3 were in fact generated by some computable process. So you're saying, imagine that. Then Solomonov-type induction reproduces the conditional probabilities of that process. Mm-hmm. But if it's not the case that there's some computable process that generated my past impressions, then there's no guarantee that the conditional probabilities I assign to future experiences will have anything to do with the simple description in the world. So it seems kind of circular. You've assumed that all my past experiences are described by some simple theory, and then that implies that my future experiences will be described by some simple theory. But how did you get to the fact that my past experiences will be described by a simple theory?
In general, they won't. Yeah, they won't. So you're not assuming this here. So there's no assumption that the previous observations that you made are somehow distributed according to some simple rule. So this?
Explain that to me, because you say, consider any computable probabilistic process that has description length L, and suppose it generates outputs x1, x2, x3. So I read that as x1 and x2, x3 have been generated by a computable, hence...
Sorry, that's not what I mean. These are not the ones the observer has seen. I just say, here's a process that generates some outputs, period. So, I can just make up some coin tossing process. Here's a coin tossing process, 70% heads, 30% tails. It's a perfect computable process. Does it generate outputs? Yes. If I want, I can run it and I get heads, tails, tails, heads, and so on. Yeah. And these outputs are distributed according to mu. Yeah. So this is a bit maybe badly formulated. I'm not making any claims about these here. I'm just saying, let's look at a stochastic process. Period, which generates outputs. Maybe a coin tossing process, for example. That would be an example. And what this thing says now is, no matter what process you look at, there's a certain probability that this process will later on describe what you see very well. So maybe you haven't made any observations so far. You're no observer. You're now starting your random process. You've not made any observation. You're thinking, what could happen to me in the future? And this theorem tells you, maybe in the future, whatever you see is just a coin tossing process with 70%, 30% probability. That could be. How likely is that? Well, to decide how likely that is, I would have to say, what's the length of a program for the coin tossing process? Maybe 10 bits. And then 2 to the minus 10 would be the probability that in like 10 years from now, this will describe what I see. Or I can look at another process, maybe. You know, game of Conway's game of life with a little probability inside. So maybe this is what I see later on as my regularities. Could that happen? Well, maybe that could happen. How probable is that this happens? Well, let's look at a program for this process. Maybe it has 100 bits length. Maybe this will happen, and the probability is 2 to the minus 100, at least.
Let me see if I've understood. If you postulate that the probability of future sequences is given by Solomonov's expression, so short description length, then you're going to say, well, the likely observations I have will be things that are simple to describe, because that's what the measure favors.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Can maybe rephrase this as a kind of consequences of the universality of the algorithmic probability?
Yes.
Is the universal computable probability that contains all the other as a sub-processes?
That's right.
Conditional probability equal
exactly
to the inverse of the length.
Exactly.
So that's the way.
It's a very good intuition. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
So, yeah, this is somehow a mixture of all computable processes anyway. Statistical mixture of those, somehow. And in the long run, if you collect more and more data and the regularities tend to stabilize themselves, you will pick out one of these computable processes and then it will remain. That's somehow the idea. So, it's basically what you said. Yes. Yeah.
2 to the minus L is still a very small number.
Yeah.
Are you happy
with it? It could be. I don't know if these numbers add up to 1. So, if this must happen, I don't know yet. Actually, you want something weaker. You don't want convergence of probabilities, but just the observations should look like distributed, like mu or something like this. So basically for every extra bit of description length, you lose probability 1/2, which is maybe not that surprising. Good. Now, computable process, it shouldn't mean that you look around and you see tapes and bits and so on, obviously. Yeah, this is more an abstract statement. It's just something that can, in principle, be simulated on a Turing machine, in principle. And you shouldn't expect to see any kind of tapes or bits around, but there are actually generic features of computational processes if they are simple. For example, that they must start in some simple initial state and then evolve. And this seems to be somewhat consistent with what we see in physics. We think we have something like low entropic initial conditions in the world that we actually see. Yeah, so that seems to be consistent with this. Yeah, so that's, it's a bit hard to digest and even harder to explain. Yeah. I hope this So somewhat understandable that you get a notion of a computable process here asymptotically. Anyway, good. Now, last part, see how far I get in the last 10 minutes. So far, this is all from the point of view of one observer, but now what if you have two? So obviously, I'm not the only person in the world, I think. How can we understand something like objectivity here? And the interesting thing is it's not automatic here, and not always true. So according to what I've shown you, if I think of different observers, A and B, then a priori, they just make their own private observations and they are not related at all. So here I can take a bunch of bit strings, x1a, x2a, and to xna, and can say, let's just call the observer to which this belongs Abby. This has a bunch of bit strings, and then I have a probability of what Abby will see next, which is just p, and so on. Here's another bunch of bit strings, and I can think of another observer that had those experiences, and it's just another probability and completely unrelated. So, yeah, in a way, the theorem that I've shown you applies separately to every observer. So A, we see something like computable A world around, yeah, maybe something you have to run around and collect points or so. B will see something like B world around. Now, a priori, that's unrelated, but now suppose that A sees something in her external world that seems very much like another observer B to her. For example, I can now point to Lydia and see Lydia pretty much looks like another observer to me, like myself. So you have A world and A in its A world, and there's this other thing here, and this other thing seems to have some information content. So I can consider it as an abstract observer. Does it make sense? So philosophically, the question we would want to ask is, does what A sees here really correspond to the first person perspective of another observer? So is that another observer somehow, yes or no? But we're not philosophers, so how can we formalize that? Here's a way to formalize it. We have A world. A world is just a stochastic process. And A itself is part of the process, so it's some random variable FA. But A can point to something else in this world, like here. Another random variable FB, which is in some other state, another bit string. So at any time step, we just read out some binary string from this world, something else, yeah, maybe Lydia's state. That's what I'm interested in now, what I'm pointing to. Yeah? And this I just encode in a function that extracts this, yes.
So when A sees another observer, does A assign, let's say, some strings of data connected to, I mean, the thing is,
Does
A see also the data, the history that B records? Or
yeah, technically I'm just looking at a bunch of bits in my world. I could look at my hard drive here. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Not interested in what this material looks like, it just read out some information. That's what we do. So.
But does A see just the other observer as a string of bits, or does A see the other observer as collecting some information and also having some kind of private?
No, so far, so just look at Lydia and I say, oh, now her brain is in state 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0.
Okay.
Now it's 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. Now she's thinking of vegan food, and so which is encoded in 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1.
Okay.
But technically, yeah, that's how we think of it. So, yeah.
Yes.
And now,
would Lydia, for instance, know the things that you think she's thinking?
That's what we're going to know. We get to this now. Yeah.
Okay.
So far, it's all technically well defined. Let's just have a random variable. Yeah. Here, string-valued random variable, and now I can look at two probability distributions that have a different interpretation. First of all, I can look at A world, and I can say A world is probabilistic, and so this variable will just change over time. So I have a distribution, how this random variable changes over time, that it's first in that state, then in that state, and so on. And that's what I call new. So it's just the probability that B, this other thing here, just is in this state x1 and then x2 and so on according to A world. It's like asking, according to the laws of physics of my world, how does Lydia's state change next? Let's put a big probability distribution on it. That's new. But Lydia, a priori, if we think of her as an observer with these states, then algorithmic probability should determine which he sees, because that's a postulate. Yeah. It's P. And a priori, these are two different things. So what does it mean? So maybe they are different then, or what does it mean? So the question, so yeah, here's an example. So maybe in A world, every day the sun is rising. And maybe Abby says, there's an almost 100% chance that the sun rises tomorrow. And so there's an almost 100% chance that I see that Bambi sees the sunrise, which would be new, this distribution that assigns 100%. But if that's the case, does actually Bambi subjectively see the sunrise tomorrow with 100% probability, yes or no? And in physics, we always think the answer must be yes, but here it doesn't have to be a priori. But here you can prove the following theorem. You can show with A world probability 1, in the long run, these two probabilities get close to each other. So the difference goes to 0. So this means if B here is somehow has run through a lot of states, so somehow B is already old enough in A world, then these two probabilities are the same. And the answer is yes. So also B will see the sunrise with probability close to 1. So after a while, these probabilities get compatible. And in this sense, we can see that they are part of the same world. Say there's like one embedding algorithm where they're both random variables. And that's a good description of what they see. Okay. Good. Now here's a surprise. This is a theorem, and the theorem relies on some assumptions, and sometimes they are not satisfied. And then we have something like probabilistic zombies. That's how I call it. So sometimes this is not true. For example, if K is small and not large. And this would be a case where A sees B see the sunrise, but B doesn't see the sunrise. And I've shamelessly stolen the pictures, probably if you've drawn them. No? Not this time? Okay. This would be a pro. Okay. Sorry. Yours would be much nicer. So here, B would be a probabilistic zombie with respect to A and vice versa. Now, here's a theorem that tells you when you have zombiness, like a criterion. Namely, if the complexity of all the states that B has seen is much less than the complexity of the probability distribution of B according to A world. So if this inequality is true, then B is a zombie for A automatically, and these two distributions are very, very different from each other. Now let's see what this means.
Can you just go back and explain again what a zombie is?
Yes, what a zombie is.
I mean, in your compared to in your theory.
Yes. So in a way, it would mean, so maybe that's me and that's Lydia, just, you know. I really think Lydia will see the sunrise tomorrow. That's here. That's like 100% probability that would assign here. So this means that the probability in this world that I'm seeing of Lydia's state tomorrow morning, of having a mental representation of seeing a sunrise, is close to 1. But it could still be true that if I just look at the abstract information content of Lydia, that according to algorithmic probability, she will not see the sunrise. Then it's like a zombie, because to me it looks as if she's really alive and sees the sunrise, but she really isn't, in some sense. It's a probabilistic version of what Wittgenstein has thought about in some very strange sense. Somehow Lydia would somehow fall off into another universe, or I don't know, it's very hard to get your intuition, your head around it. But that would be a zombie. Another question is, when does it happen? And here's a criterion when it happens. This inequality says you have zombiness. And this can happen, for example, if k of x is very small. And what this means, for example, is that whatever is here in Lydia's brain is just too simple. But that would, of course, just not happen for Lydia. But maybe I just look at the blackboard, I write down a 0. And I look at the 0 and look at the 0 and look at the 0, and that's now the observer I'm pointing to. That's a very simple one. And so obviously, the probabilities that this changes when I write now a 1. Ah, that has changed. So there was a 50% probability that it changes. That does not doesn't have anything to do with algorithmic probability. It has to be, have some minimal complexity. What would be the other thing would be that K of nu is too large. That would mean that if I look at the distribution of her thoughts according to the laws of nature, then this would be very, very complex. And when would this happen? Not for Lydia again, but this would mean that I point to something in my world in a just too complicated way. So, for example, I look at the background radiation of the microwave background and take the XOR with some radio transmission, and that's the information that I read out. Then this complexity would be very large, that describes the probability distribution of my outputs. And then also, I would not be guaranteed that the probabilities that I see this changing has anything to do with some kind of subjective probability of that thing. And Boltzmann brains are another example, because if the universe is really large, then I read a really large amount of information to pick out a Boltzmann brain that's very far out there and to point to it. That would make chi of nu very large. So, and that's how you get rid of Boltzmann brains. They are zombies. So, and I should really stop soon, but another surprise is that you can say something about emulation. So if you believe what I've told you, if you just assume, make these assumptions, then obviously you can also point to something that's in your computer simulation. You can ask, is that now a zombie, yes or no? Yeah, and related questions. And I don't have very much time to go into that. Let me just say, at some point in time, we'll probably have to think about this. At some point, we will be able to simulate observers. And then maybe we can, you know, our kids will want to use them in horrible computer games to shoot them. I don't know. Should we allow this or should we not? So in a way, you can also say something about that. So in practice, it's pretty difficult. But you can try, and then what you find is that somehow it makes a big difference if your simulation is open or closed. So open would be you feed a lot of data, you talk to the simulated agent, you feed a lot of data from the outside world inside. And closed means you just let it run and don't ever interfere. And that makes a big difference about the matter of fact as to whether this corresponds to an actual first-person perspective or not. Okay, which is obviously counterintuitive, but if you believe the postulate, then you get this. All right, I should conclude. So we have a bunch of pluses and minuses here. I mean, maybe the overall conclusion is that yes, we can somehow start in principle with the first-person perspective and obtain some notion of emergent external world, which seems to be consistent with known physics. Yeah, so this remains to be seen. Now, of course, there's a minus, big minus, is that this is so far from the usual regime of physics that it's useless for most things that physicists usually want to think about. But, you know, it allows to address some fundamental problems rigorously that we normally address with much less rigor. For example, why do we have a world at all? What about the Boltzmann problem, brain problem, and so on? You get a framework to address these things if you believe the basic postulate. It's not the final world, there's open problems. Hopefully it's fun. And so I see it as a kind of proof of principle that we can have such a thing. And it has at least some explanatory and predictive power. Good, so here are the papers. There's a very long version, and there's a very not so good, very short, not so short version, but shorter version. So thanks for your attention. Right. Do I lose now my PI visitor status? Yeah, I mean, hopefully not for quantum foundations. So it'll be something in the afternoon I say about pretty much everything else. So, I mean, the only other area of physics that touches it indirectly is cosmology, the Boltzmann brains and so on. But even there, all it says is that, no, you cannot use this argument to constrain your cosmological model, period. Yeah, so maybe that's not so useful or not as useful as you might want to have. But it cannot be because it tells you in a way that some of the regularities that we see are just random. or contingent. And so it cannot explain those. It just says you had, you know, we have a bunch of laws. They're probably simple, but what they are is not determined a priori. This is why it somehow predicts its own limitations in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you face all this in terms of chances, mm-hmm. and but mentioned that it's the theory is sort of agnostic about how probabilities are interpreted, and you mentioned also that you could see them in an epistemic way. Now, how does that work?
Yeah. So what you could do is you could say, well, of course there's a world, yeah, and physics helps us understand this world. And physics is very good for many things, but there are these puzzles out there, for example, this Boltzmann brain thingy. Where is it? The Boltzmann brain problem. It's just, I cannot open a textbook and read a theory and directly apply it and get the answer right away. You say, physics doesn't help me to understand this, but so Lomonosov induction, algorithmic probability, agrees with physics in our usual physics regime. So then let's just extrapolate this and let's use it also for this other regime where physics has trouble to tell me what's going on. So you can see this as a kind of extrapolation of induction outside its realm in physics. And this you can justify even if you believe that there's a world and we just don't know it and we're using induction to wrap our head around it. But then you may want to ask these other strange questions about simulation and Boltzmann brains. And then you just say, well, then let's use Solomonov induction to answer what would I see in this case. It's like a rule of thumb that you extrapolate Solomonov induction to a larger regime, I would say.
Some of the results you've presented are of the flavor that in the limit of large sets of data, different observers would converge to have the same kind of view of the world. So in spirit, this is similar to what the Definetti theorem is doing, or at least the finite versions of that, and plus this dimension of the computability aspect. Have you thought about like if this could be viewed as a sort of algorithmic version of Definetti's theorem, like how this...
Definetti's theorem, maybe not directly because you don't have exchangeability in some formally well-defined sense.
Do you have exchangeability here?
Not really. So these are not stationary measures that are permutation invariant or anything. But you could say, well, there's Bayesianism and there's Bayesian coherence, for example, which just tells you that in the long run, even if you have different priors, you will converge to the same posterior distribution. Some of this is very much in that spirit, just interpreted in a different way.
But wouldn't you have exchangeability for the algorithmic probability?
In what
sense?
It seems
to be kind of independent of
probability. Not quite. You could say if I have a simple permutation, then it's almost invariant with respect to it. Something like this. But the order matters, yeah. You have 10 to the 20 zeros and then 10 to the 20 ones. It's very simple. Now you permute it, shuffle it around, then it gets very complex. Really. So this algorithmic probability is not invariant with respect to this. But there are similarities to these kind of things, indeed. Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand your solution to the Boltzmann brain.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like what you were saying is that once you look from the point of view of algorithmic probability, then regularities persist, and that's the argument.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like in the very problem as it's posed, it's acknowledged that regularities tend to persist, and that's why this is confusing. And
I'm
not sure I got the crux of what you're arguing.
So in a way, you're saying... Okay, I mean, what you can say is the following. Yeah, you can.
And I wanted to end it.
Okay.
So the point of the problem then was that for a large enough universe, no matter how small the probability is, whether it's given by algorithmic probability or something else, for a large enough universe, it will always happen somewhere.
Yes, it will always happen somewhere. That's true.
And so how does this approach up with them?
Yeah, so in a way, here it's not really relevant what happens somewhere. Yeah. That's not what determines what's happening to you or what the observer sees, but there is something that acts directly on the observer. Okay, maybe let me go back to what you said first. You said, oh, I'm puzzled because here, these people also acknowledge that regularities tend to persist. So how does what I do solve this? Well, what these people would say is, yeah, usually regularities do persist, but this other argument of counting tells us that here, suddenly I'm expecting they don't persist. Because there's so many Boltzmann brains that I expect this very strange thing to happen next. According to some understanding of physics. And this understanding of physics is basically to say how probable something is, go out and count. And that's what the puzzle is, like usually irregularities. But here there's this other argument which says you it breaks down. Now my resolution here tells you counting is irrelevant. Yeah. Counting is irrelevant, it's regularities that's relevant in the first place. That's why even if there are so many Boltzmann brains out there, even then, should you expect to still see the regularities that you've seen before? So that's the way we need to see all of this together.
So does your approach then not deny that Boltzmann brains will exist? You're just not worried about it happening to you?
So the Boltzmann brains exist, but they are zombies in the sense that I've shown in the last slides. Yeah, yeah, of course. It's like watching a movie. If I put a DVD with, you know, some movie about science fiction, people fighting aliens and watch it on the TV, then yeah, it looks to me as if there's something going on, but there isn't really. There isn't really an alien that's kind of, or, you know, it's like watching a movie. And the Boltzmann brain is also like watching a movie. I just look out there and I see this fluctuation, and then the fluctuation disappears. But there's not really anybody that would feel like this fluctuation. Because for that other thing, it's not the fluctuation that's relevant, but algorithmic probability in the end. So it's a bit like, and also you see slowly why it's very hard to convey the intuition for this worldview. But it's a bit this picture here. This, where are you? Here, yeah. Like, yeah, you look in the sky, you see this Boltzmann brain up there. But it's, you know, it doesn't mean that there is an actual Boltzmann brain that is really surprised in the next moment, like, oh, where am I? And then disappearing. Subjectively, from a first person perspective, it's not. Something else is happening to that thing. This is a prediction that's usually not made by physics. That's the new thing. Usually we have a very strong version of objectivity. We see something, and then if we put ourselves in these shoes, then this is what's happening to them. And we just see in the Boltzmann brain problem, this runs into trouble. And this trouble is here resolved, but at the cost of some counterintuitive non-objectivity sometimes. Yes.
So this year, you just mentioned that first-person experience is tied to evolution according to algorithmic probability. Did you expand on this before? Did I miss that, or is that something you just threw in this? And, I mean, is this somewhere you are in? Do you have a posture that is the first person experience? Is that or?
Well, I hope so. But yeah, it's so yeah, more or less here.
So it's subjective, okay.
So I mean, the thing is, yeah, you can put five lines, and then you can do and prove stuff. To get a bit intuition, you have to have some extra ideas, like how to interpret this. Obviously, there's a few ideas around that about how to think of this. Somehow to think of that is whenever you write down a bunch of zeros and ones, then in principle, I can think of an observer that is in that state. There is somehow a way of being in that state. First-person perspective that's described by that for every such string, and vice versa.
That would be true whether or not these strings evolve according to sort of model.
Yeah, and they don't really evolve. I'm not saying here somewhere in the world there's this box, and in this box this process is running, is really going on. It's just this is just really a claim about what happens subjectively to you. That you've been in some state, you'll be in some state next, and it's not arbitrary which one happens, but it's a probability distribution that governs what your next state is. It doesn't really make a mechanistic claim about stuff moving around or the process being built somewhere or anything like that.
If the conditionalization is made is kind of equivalent with memorization, is it like legit to say that the sort of law that's like probabilistic here is actually like the law of how memory evolves and not how the...
In a way, that's true, yeah. So because, for example, it could be that just a second ago we've switched identities. Yeah, you've been actually here, you've lived my life until 1 second ago, and then we switched. But since we switched all memories, we don't realize it. Does it contradict anything we know about physics? No. But it would contradict this thing here. That kind of tells you that what I see next would somehow fit to what I've seen before, and so I will not be Rishik in 1 second from now. So what this also does, it encodes some kind of identity for you, including memory in a way. So in this sense, you're right. Yeah.
Question about the chance versus epistemic interpretation of these. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the Diffinetti theorem, if you thought that, you know, a dice had some chance associated with different outcomes, you might have said, I'll assign an epistemic probability distribution over those possible biases, and I'll write it down like that. And then Diffinetti showed, well, you don't need to assume that there's some chances. You can just say, you know, you believe, you don't change your beliefs under these exchanges, and therefore you should assign the same form of probability distribution. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's a similar move you can make here. You say, I don't need to presume a world wherein Y is chosen probabilistically based on the algorithmic probability theory. Mm-hmm. I think all I would need to do is have an observer, suppose they believe that what they're seeing mm-hmm. is the output of some program. Mm-hmm. And they know nothing about what the input of that program is, so they assign a uniform distribution. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to say, all right, well, I should reason according to this algorithmic mm-hmm. prior, and I should update mm-hmm. my beliefs. Every time I see something, I update my beliefs about what I'll see next based on this assumption. Mm-hmm. And I haven't needed to say that there's any chances in the world in any random processes, and I get exactly the same kinds of predictions and theorems as you've described. So why shouldn't we consider it all evidence that there is this unknown program with an unknown input, and everything we see is consistent with that?
So I wouldn't see it in that way. I wouldn't see it that this thing is somehow evidence for the non-existence of a world, because I think you never need evidence for non-existence. You need evidence for existence. So suppose I can tell you, well, whatever I see here, I can explain it without assuming the tooth fairy. Just, you know, I just bought this somewhere, and it's not the tooth fairy who brought it. So then I just get rid of the hypothesis of tooth fairy and have a simpler theory. And here I would say the same. I think I just don't need to assume a world. And then why not get rid of
it? I don't think I was trying to say assume a world.
Yeah.
I'm trying to ask, why do you assume what you assume, which is namely that there are chances in the world, and those chances are determined by the Solomonov prior, whereas I'm saying,
okay.
No, yeah. Just assume that there's only your observations. Mm-hmm. They're generated by
some process,
like abstractly by a Turing machine. That's
okay.
My assumption. So
okay.
I have to say
okay.
There's a physical Turing machine in the world, but it's just like, what's the mechanism that generates my experiences, which is all there is? Answer, it's a Turing machine process. It's an algorithm. Mm-hmm. That's what generates it. There's no chances in the world. It's just this algorithm.
Okay,
so that's my assumption.
Good.
And it seems like everything you said would be consistent with that interpretation, because such an observer would reason exactly as your observers, who believe that there's these chances in the world, would mm-hmm. reason. Mm-hmm. So what evidence do you have for there being chances in the world in this framework?
Well, I think you can do two things. You can say, I assume that there is some given thing, some world or some process, well, that's just there, that's actually there, and that determines what's going on. Maybe I don't know it. That's the usual view of things. Once you have that, this is perfectly fine. Then you can say, well, now I can start thinking about missing knowledge and about epistemically about probabilities. And then I can try to get information on this and make predictions and so on, and then have the usual Bayesian view on probability, and I can say algorithmic probability is now my tool, my Bayesian tool to predict what I see, and then in the end I will find the actual algorithm that was there from the start anyway. That's one way to see it. But the thing is that once you say, let's not assume this, once you're specifically not making this assumption, then there is just nothing that you can be Bayesian about. So then you need something else that gives you some notion of some things being more likely than others. Like if I don't see if I, you know, I drop this and it tends to fall down instead of up, if there's no force or world that does it, then I at least need to talk about a chance that the chance is somehow higher that it falls down than it falls up. So I can only, you know, I need one element of my theory that gives me some kind of oomph, some kind of power or some kind of something that's not me that determines what's happening.
I think I understand your answer, but let me point out that maybe it's not so different from what you had. So So in the theory I was proposing, there's, you know, some strings that are the experience of the observer, and then there's a whole bunch of other strings that would be sort of everything else that I'm ignorant of that's going to determine the next thing. And you're saying, well, you know, think of that as an external world, and you don't want to do that. But in a theory that has chances, you could say, is the string describing previous experiences all there is? I would say no, because there are chances. What are chances? Chances are real numbers, right? So there's these sort of floating propensities that are described by these real numbers in the world, and that are setting what's going to happen next. So I've got a big long string. You've got some real numbers. They serve the same role. Is it really so much better to say, you know, just the experiences plus these real numbers, which determine chances? Like, what if I said those real numbers are not part of the observer? They're your external world. You're making the external world these sort of chancy real numbers. I'm making it this other string. It seems equivalent.
So in a way, you can say, you have a world here, which is just these P's, these real numbers. They just determine what's going on. So why is that so different? Granted, that's possible. Still, you can just compare this view with the standard view, like two pictures of the world. And then you find that this view has a bunch of advantages. And one of the advantages is, for example, when you look at these strange thought experiments, like what if you simulate an observer? What about Boltzmann brains? I think in the standard picture, the one that you sketched, you can feel maybe there's this Turing machine computation that I just don't know. Then you can still ask all these questions and you won't get easily an answer. It's not clear how to answer the question of, you know, maybe there are a lot of copies of you in the Turing machine somehow out there on the tape. What should I make of them? Should I count them? It's, you know, all these questions that are raised in the beginning. I think in order to address, you have an advantage somehow to address them when you think in these lines. Because then you can talk directly about what an observer sees. And you don't have to say, here's the world, and everything derives from the world, and how can I now, using this world, predict or decide whether this Boltzmann brain argumentation is true. So there are advantages of this ontology. Even though it's also about some kind of world, namely these real numbers here, as you point out. It's a different kind of world, hopefully with advantages for tackling these problems. Does that make sense?
I was going to say, let's continue.
Let's continue downstairs. We get cookies now, and then we can go to this workshop tomorrow. So let's thank Marcus again.
Thank you.